Welcome to the 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast, a retrospective.
Hey folks, DJ here. I just want to take some time to talk about Werewolf the Apocalypse Retaliations by Flyles Games. This soon-to-launch game is brought to you by the same team that's bringing you Vampire the Masquerade Chapters, and they just released a trailer to go along with it. We at 25 invite you to check it out at werewolftheapocalypse-retaliation.com to catch a peek at the trailer and be updated of when it'll appear on Kickstarter, which seems to be early 2022. The game promises to have everything that made Chapters endearing to us, the fans, including scenarios, investigations, beautiful miniatures, and more. With that, thanks for your time.
Hello, one and all, and welcome back to another 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade presents. This review is not gonna be Werewolf. I have to let you know, V5's butting in again, dropping their new Children of the Blood book. And I believe that came out, yesterday, I want to say, officially? That's what it is, something like that, maybe the day before. Either way, we crammed. I know we jumped in, dove all over to get this out in time. And because we know that V5, everyone loves it, and we want to know more about it. And also, we have a certain love for the lady gamer, Matthew Dawkins, so we know we're crucial to the creation of this book and seeing it through. And I like it when those two team up. I feel there's a real, even when we interviewed him, there was a real energy you could feel where that creativity just flowed back and forth. And so I was excited to get to it. But I know what you're thinking. Bob, what the hell happened to Pentex Monkey Wrench? That's the next book. That's Werewolf. You said, you promised. Yeah, and then I read it again. And,
Did you read all of it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Let me tell you what that book is. It's basically, it was written in a time when green screen was a factor, right? We were just like, you know, kind of marching forward. I mean, there's like a bitmap printout for a layout that you want to give to your characters about the nefariousness of Pentax, right?
When he means green screen, he means the text on your computer monitor, right? He's talking about a time before we had a graphical user interface when the experience of a computer was just lines of text flying forward.
When we were looking at the actual Methuselah chilled that sits in the Pentax board, I was like, Well, we'll get to that on another way, because that book doesn't. That book doesn't really get to the meat of what's going on there, other than to say that this is here, interesting sire, here's what the chill's about, here's some ridiculous... Folks, we're talking, there's a level 8 Auspex power printed in this book that allows that Malkavian to use some stuff to... They're not even the gen to use it, just they can. But they're able to enter the digital web for me. At this point, I was like, that's all that there is in this book, and it was endless. Like, it would take me more time to research Mage, to explain the digital realm, to explain how a vampire gets to enter it, to explain why it matters to Pentex, to explain its relevance to vampire, but we still haven't talked about werewolf, right, is where that is. And so I said, you know, we're not doing it. There's other pods for werewolf out there. We hope you enjoy Monkey Wrench. I'm positive people have used it to good effect and have fun. A lot of good talks, a lot of STs were helped with those printouts. But ultimately, it's a book to help you with stills for your game to hand out to your players to do it. And it requires some updating, major updating, to be useful even now. However, interesting for collectors, go get it. Enjoy it for that alone if you want. We have our copies. So
it's like if you were trying to compare the movie Hackers to the movie Swordfish in complexity of technology, and then realize that Swordfish is 20 years old.
Yeah, I don't know what either of those movies are, but I would like to thank everyone for tuning in to our quick 3-minute review of Pentex Monkey Wrench.
That's rude.
We didn't think we were going to get to it, but here we are.
We did not get to it. People are owed an explanation, Bertrand. What did I tell you? Quit and slap yourself. I told you, Devil Monkey. I said, this is how it is, right? You're going to...
Listen, it's not his fault. He wasn't born when those movies came out, sir.
See, the Black Dragon's a cool name sounding to some people, but there's a reason he was given that name, and one of them is Scorched Fucking Earth. With Brentron, it's always Scorched Earth. It's never explained anything. Just rock it through. They'll figure it out. Listen, youngin', we slow it down. Take a casual walk here at 25, all right?
All right. So, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll go get my Arnold Palmer so I can, like, chill out.
What we're telling you about is how to romance.
Calm down in the rain,
sir.
Okay? That's what we're saying.
Okay.
All right. Shifting gears. Rain is good. Anyway, shifting gears and moving back to it. Children of the Blood. What we're going to preface this book with, we're going to tell you the obvious. Children of the Blood is going to be very familiar to fans of a vampire period, no matter where you're at. I really think it's cool. Paradox allowed this type of It was fan sourced to see the creation of this, which is awesome. That it, you know, time investment, whatnot, wisdom in it, and listening to your fans to produce a book of this caliber. And it is mostly a series of SPCs that are in this book detailing beings ready and set to be in a cult, is what it is, or some sort of reason why I don't say just a cult. They even add this cool smart forward, where they explain the fact that you could take anybody in here and really mishmash your idea of where they fit better, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's one thing you can do. And so keep an open mind when you read through the book. That's what they're not explaining. Some of you are going to grab this and go, canon. That's... I'm sorry, 1994. You got to understand that we're not in that era anymore. And we've updated where it's all inclusive. And everybody wants what they want. Every game is going to be different based on the ST running it and the troop playing it. So that being the case, they somehow wrote a book that addresses all that for everyone. And that's what they do. So I want to stress that when we go over the few key characters we're going to pick, because we're not going to go over over 50 pages. We're not going to do them all. Because all right. We want to get to actually the cool metrics at the end as well they included in here. Like bloodline lore sheets and things of that nature. So... Without further ado, though, I told Nick I need a guinea pig to talk about the intro story. He said, I'm all about it. Hit us, Nick. What's the cool intro story in this book?
With a Church of Set Tremere, and the two of them have this exchange back and forth where there's a blackmail put in place. And really, at the end of the day, the exchange is interesting in the way that the narrative format of the story flows. It's in two time frames that run sequentially, alternating as it goes through, and the way it steps through the story, different things are revealed to you, which you slowly realize that the power dynamic has completely shifted from the beginning to the end, and the experience you were getting at the beginning of the story is painted in an entirely different light. So it's extremely well written. I'm beyond impressed. So congrats, exemplary work.
He's a fan of it. What'd you guys think?
I thought it was the same thing. I thought it was great to see the power dynamic, but what I thought was really great was with the first couple of pages alone, it just stresses to you how important it is for a vampire to feed and how much time it actually takes to feed, right? Some one of the things that we normally find at a table is, I'm hungry, or I'm already getting to that point, and then we usually hand wave it by going like, all right, let's roll some dice. But one of the things to take into consideration is it's an art, right? This is the reason why feeding types are very important, is because Baptiste, this Nephilim Toreador, is spending time investing in his meal, making sure everything's going the right way. And he almost has his meal on a hook before it gets interrupted. And as a predator, right, even cats, like, you're coming to take my food away? I could only, you know, like, the frustration alone. But I love the fact that it spent a lot of time outlining just how much time it does take to prep your meal, right? How important it is for you to feed.
All night on one meal.
Does that make sense, though?
Depending on your feeding style, yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I'm just challenging what you said. I think it's very healthy to have that happen, to hear that out. But like, when you say it makes sense that it takes all night, should that be every time? Is that a typical, or are we doing it wrong when we run games? Should there be a time limit when you feed, or is it just Eddie Webb is focusing on that normally hand wave aspect? What do you think?
I think he's breathing for this life vampire, into it. Yeah, I was about to say breathing life, but it's also his particular. He's a consensualist. He's trying to figure it out. You could also be the smash and grab type, right? It's like, hey, there, right outside of a bar. Whoop! I got to feed. I ain't got time to seduce and or worry about what the mortal thinks. Yum yum, gotta go. It's takeout here.
Well, I agree. I think the story does all that. I think it does highlight how to feed and time and length and basically how something innocuous and simple. And I think a lot of fans, you know, we've been doing this a long time, playing with Vampire for most people who are fans of the genre still. You really don't think of feeding after a while, right? Some players just don't put thought into it. They move on. And so we get blood, we move on, we're good. Even in the V5 games I've seen, it's like, even though we've hosted, it's like, you know, you want to do a good feeding scene with somebody and a player just doesn't care. Just, we were in the middle of something, let's roll our die to start the night and move on. You can do that, especially if there's more of the focus on, but what makes you a vampire? And I think that's what that story does. It definitely dips that back into it. Now, another thing that the story does, it preps you for the rest of the book. Right, understanding this is a unique day in the life for these two people, it rolls right into the fact that you can start on those SPCs and get to reading about some unique characters. First and foremost, the structure of how these characters are built. I like how there's an epitaph. We got rid of the idea of concept. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Epitaph. If this person died, what would they be known for? Right? And off the bat, this Florian Ribeiro is a mathematics savant, is what we have in here. And before you think, oh, cool, that's in there. So the guy does math, and he's liked by Tremere, who found a way to use math to do things, to move on. You would be mistaken. This guy is well-written for one reason, and that is the interchangeability of his story period. Right? We have him here where he runs into Roger de Camden, the prince over in London, and to fulfill his goal of using math to basically get rid of the idea of kindred. Right, that kindred and God, blah blah blah, explained. He's using mathematics to explain everything, and that he has a big thing with it. A pretty much rock solid mortal perception. I made an immortal now, but I don't want to deal with the fact I'm a monster. I'm gonna hyper focus on what I'm good at, and that's what I did when I'm breathing, and I have all this time to do it. I'm still gonna do it. But he was born in like what, 96 and embraced in 2021. So this guy is baby new. Right? Right there in it. He's free to have that, and it's written to show that. Even to the fact, and I applaud that the author put in there, whoever made this character, that they said the prince is annoyed with dealing with this guy. This dude's annoying. You know, it's just, I want you to join the Mithraic cult. Just step in. Shut up. Like, you know, you're too young to be, yes, healthy mind and all that, but, you know, one day, can you please hurry up and understand murder is going to, okay, sure. We'll talk about Mithras. And it's kind of cool the way they write it, because it is almost exhausting to read about him. Not for you. For you, it's entertaining, but you could see how the feel and the play of stepping into this role would be someone who has to explain everything through the medium of that he understands the world with his mathematics. Now, the one thing I noticed was that I wanted to change and shift gears, because to me, he's Cult of Shalim 100%. He's better suited for Cult of Shalim. I like the idea that we took a happy, sunshiny, flowery perspective of where this person went. But when I read this, I read a great tragedy here. You got to understand what gematria is, right? And gematria is literally the numerology that is in the Cult of Shalim, but it's a killing name, right? Depending on where you're looking at and sourcing it, when you look that up, it talks about the fact that gematria could be the discovery of God in numerology. Like, literally the key to the universe, of creation itself. And once you do that, and you solve the mathematical formulae for what God is, then what is the rest of existence? And that becomes a more compelling story. Now, in the Cult of Shalim, he'll never do it. He'll never figure it out, right? There's a fun song written by Slipknot called Gematria, I believe. It's a line in there. Gematria is a killing name. I actually feel that cult embodies that. That the aspect is once you discover it, you're going to unwrite yourself, is what it feels like. Go back to the beginning, what is it, the Big Bang, and nothing existed before then? You mathematically figure out what, how to recreate it or to understand it? What do you do? Either way, he's going to wash who he was because he's immortal. And the cold-blooded thing about being immortal, no matter what your viewpoint, it is subject to change moment to moment. You can never die on your hill. You will always find a circumstance capable of manipulating you off from your most staunch beliefs, which is the whole basis of cults in general and the creation of them. And you know, they highlight that in Cult of the Blood Gods, right? That there's, look at all this crazy cult popping up, why all of a sudden? I think there's that guy who was that biker gang who left a diary behind Exert, if you remember that story, talking about, you know, he was either him and his biker gang group were trying to find a anybody to destroy, like Sabbat or Anarchs, and bring proof to a prince they're effective and do whatever, but they couldn't find anybody.
I remember that.
But they could find two cults that were battling over a graveyard, and how crazy that was. Now I want to bring you back to when Vampire started and where it was. Like, we're talking First and Revised, right? That period where we knew the end was coming once they announced it, and how everybody was upset, but nobody wanted to look at what that would look like. Well, V20 steps you into that era. V5 is kind of, you're almost living that era, right? It's before the fallout, but here it is, and now religious insanity is here. And to me, I just felt that this guy, either way you choose, whether it's Mithraicist or Cult of Shalim, he has a strong future and a rock solid character because of that.
Agreed. I'm completely about it. In fact, it it's funny that you should mention it, because when I first read him, I saw him as the dupe, right? The one that's getting hooked into this Mithraic cult. But I didn't consider the Shalamite aspect of it, if only because, you know, that, and that's one thing that's going to breathe life into it, especially in proving once again to the point that you could take this character and put it anywhere. But I could see himself unraveling as well. Given enough time, given the right ears, this could happen. And you could also make him the target of a Shalamite who happens to be nearby, trying to destabilize the entirety of Camden's rule.
100%. To that basis, only because of the order we have in the room, Bruntron, take a stab. Who's one of the ones you picked out of the SBC bucket?
So the first one I picked out, her name is, it's pronounced Wraith? It looks like Rays, right? But apparently, according to Google, it's pronounced as Wraith. This is she is the only Baharist that's listed in the book, and that's what drew my attention to her. First off, not going to lie, I'm a big Baharist fan. So reading through this person, the first thing that struck out to me about her was that her background was weirdly normal. Other than, like, it seemed as though this was someone who, it was, what I mean by that, it felt like this was a living person that did become a vampire. This really struck into the personal horror aspect of vampire, at least in this character. Her background, she's an Argentinian, she's a writer, and specifically she was like a propaganda writer during their war for independence against Spain. Right. And during this war, she had a lover at the time, but they got split apart after the war. And how she ends up becoming embraced is, at first she's ghouled because her writing was so inspiring, was so insightful, that it caught the attention of a Lamia. This Lamia traced her connection to this lover, blackmailed him by saying, "Hey, you're going to give me this girl or I'm going to torture and kill your family." And he did. And that betrayal in her eyes was a lasting wound that she kept even throughout all of her own life. Right, that's a defining moment for her after she becomes a ghoul, and then later after she becomes embraced. And after she becomes embraced, she starts traveling. Right, she leaves her sire, as all chill do at some point, and she starts roaming from city to city. And the first night she stayed in another city, she was staying in an apartment, and she heard a neighbor next door being beaten by her husband or boyfriend. And that was apparently one of the first times she had ever frenzied. She woke up, there was blood across the wall, and she had to flee after that. But that became another defining moment for her after that. And the rest of her existence has been her traveling from city to city after subsequent explosions into frenzy, and leaving behind body trails of people she believes are abusers, are deserving to die. And she has along the way, she's spreading the message of the Bahari cause, or Bahari faith, I guess.
So I guess what I got to say here is, as we got you, this is a very thorough read. Obviously, you read it, right? And that's there. But you say this is something you were drawn to, you thought it was well written. I agree with you. I'm not taking away from it. But I think for what the Baharis were to what they are now, right, in at least the V5 Bahari, you said this is a normal person that got embraced in, if I'm paraphrasing correctly. That got drawn in and led in to do this. How? Where is that connection? Like you said, you felt that there was, other than well written, what about Baharis does she scream out to you for?
So when I was saying she was well written, seemed like a normal person, that was honestly her time as a mortal. That was before Bahari comes in, right? What I mean by that is she was a human being that, she's not like a strong fighter, right? But even then, she still had a cause that she took up while she was alive and pursued that. She had, it showed that she had connections, not just to her brother and father, which her background goes into talking about, but also with this love interest, Joaquin, right? I mean, they describe that there's a bittersweet ending there, and it felt not romanticized, but honestly, like I was reading someone else's story or talking with a friend, you know, about earlier years. That's what it reminded me of. Now, for the Baharist side of it, I was a slightly disappointed with the Baharist aspect of it, because I felt it was very shallow. I felt like when I think Baharist, I think more like a trial through tribulation, right? That someone grows through adversity and even through failure or losing struggles, right? And I didn't really see that with her. I actually felt she, as a as an SPC, is actually very stagnant with her repeating the cycle of going from city to city.
The thing on there, I would remind you, is it's something I would have... well, you see a lot of people, they look for like a failure to define them, mm-hmm. or what have you. When you're a vampire, you're more like a ghost. And you're observing, you're like doomed to repeat the same things you're drawn to as if you're expecting a different outcome. And it's not, no, I'm not referring to the insanity of it. I'm referring to the fact that when is she going to get the lesson? Right? Mm-hmm. She'll keep being drawn to it until she progresses further in her garden, as that stated. Right.
I guess what the part I was disappointed by was that it still feels like she's in the first leg of her journey through that garden, right? She's not gone through that first lesson. And I guess that's what I was expecting with an SCP. And saying this out loud, that's not bad. That's where that character is on that, you know, on that journey, right? But I don't know. I guess I was hoping for one that was a little bit longer.
You got Honeydew.
I also think that's kind of clever, though, right? Because when you think about it a lot, and it's perfect we get to speak about this on the air. Every time we read something, even as, you know, the reader, and even for our players who are listening, or even ourselves being players, we always come up with the thought process of, we want the full picture. We want to get ready served this end goal, right? Of like, this person should already be at an X level of something. And then to see this, to know that this is coming up, is really, really, really good. I thought that I thought it was very clever, because it gives someone a leg up to kind of just be there.
Well, I saw someone that it's not too much of a deviation, I think, from this character in the idea of the wronged powerful woman. The one that stuck out to me was Misery, for a handful of reasons.
Yes.
And I don't think I'm the only person in this room.
No, I think we all, so, at one point or another, chose Misery. But go ahead. I think this is
right,
a good
jump on. Yeah. So Misery is, she's a rebellious teen from an affluent family out in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And like all rebellious teens, you know, of influence, they decide that they're going to, you know, do crazy punk things. She jumps out, starts a punk band, you know, kind of does her whole thing, catches the attention of someone out in Vancouver who would be looking for someone of good breeding, but also rebellious in their own right. Of course, the Prince Siegfried, who sees a lot of potential in this young lady. And he starts doing this dance with her and eventually comes to the conclusion that he wants to embrace her. But aha, there's a trick. Somehow, back in the day when he was battling for Vancouver for control, he ended up owing a life boon to some guy named Marcus, out in the middle of nowhere, who came to his aid. And just as it would be, the night he was going to embrace her, you know, and declare to the court, you know, this Marcus fella shows up into Vancouver and says, "Ah, I will take my boon. I will take this chilled to be of yours." And so she ends up being this person who gets battered around from side to side between these two elders in some weird power game that she doesn't understand. And obviously she grows to resent them, and they eventually get tired of her, and eventually she just kind of gets cast aside and off to her rebellious ways. And that's where she ends up finding the Church of Cain. And being the hot-headed destructionist that she is, she wants to, she wants to get revenge against this idea that the church stands for, and she feels like the only way to really combat that is to destroy it from the inside, to corrupt it as the worm inside the apple.
I loved this character. This entire book, this is my favorite one. And this one, I was reading this, I was like, in my mind, she makes a great Baharist. And especially, like, tearing down the Church of Cain from the inside. Because how she does that, like, one of the ways she does that, right, is she's a deacon. She tests the new blood coming in. But she will beat the crap out of them. She is that harsh, like, taskmaster. And she doesn't do that because she hates them or she's even trying to find the faithful. She's like, "Hey, stupid, they don't care about you. Get out. Go leave."
Right. But DJ, who is her sire?
Sejanus? You mean Marcus Vittel? Yeah. That was a bomb drop there.
I had to do a double take. I was like, Marcus Vittel? No. No, it can't be. And I had to double check. I was like, yeah. And that raised so many questions because in her background, what's up?
He gets brought up twice in backgrounds in this book.
He does.
Marcus Vittel.
But it's interesting because, like, one aspect of it that, you know, we didn't talk about is, like, what he... One of the things that Marcus does is, or Sejanus at this point, is that he uses her as a palate cleanser for other elders. It's like, hey, you want a taste of my blood? Here you go. Insidiously, though, you know, when you're taking a look at her profile and everything she has on there, she's run the gamut. And I think it's not far from Lysandra ideal to test you, because most of them are done when they're mortals. He's doing it during her embrace. He's doing it while she's a vampire, right? Like, here's your kill list. Here's exactly what this is your trials and tribulations. You have names of Primogen, princes, etc. You might have it against me and other people, but this is only teaching you how to be stronger in some ways. And I think for me, what I thought was the cooler part about her background is she does embrace the Church of Cain, if only to gain the secrets and powers, and then know that it's going to be hollowed out from the inside, which I thought was interesting, because one of the other things you take a look at when you're attempting to play a cult is, all right, I'm going to join a cult, I'm going to create a character, and I'm going to be all about it. Let me go ahead and deeply research. But what if you just play that person who joins just because, like a nominal Catholic, right? I'm just, yep, I got baptized, I'm good. I go to church every other Sunday. But this is like one of those types of characters, like, who doesn't have to be fully invested into it.
Mm-hmm. The person who shows up to church because they don't want to hear it from their mom.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, only it's their sire. All right, fine. I'll see you at the Mithras Club. All right.
It's a thing, though, that they point out here, that the aspect of being in a cult is almost synonymous with coterie. Right? What's a cult? It's not a group of people meeting in a cave that are discussing religion. It doesn't start there. It starts as a group of people, well, at least in this case, it starts as a coterie looking for affirmation, belonging, and a sign that they're doing good with their immortality or where they're at, that then have to find further, what does it all mean? And then they agree to that set of beliefs, and that's what makes that cult, because it sets them apart from everybody else, or the non-believers.
Well, Bob, my man, you have dug your shovel into an interesting grave, because in this book, it actually talks about the concept of coteries in V5 and how to kind of look at them slightly differently. They talk about the idea of a single vampire and how you lose yourself and everything you were, and that a coterie is part of that group that comes to you and helps bind and root you. And that's not much different than kind of a family you would find in a cult, the family that you find in a coterie. And they can be one and the same, or they can be separate things.
They could. I don't like the hard fast that it does, because first off, I don't like to view people that weak. That you're walking around and suddenly you're immortal and you're struggling with that and you can't figure it out. That's the worst taste that I've ever had, for that people have come away from reading books, is that being in V5, you have to be in a blood cult. Being in V5, you have to now subscribe to a lore sheet and do all this and be all that. I was like, why? No, you don't. Like, there's...
Mm-hmm. No, you don't.
And that's the absolutely thing. Like, not. In the purpose of talking about this book, we said it in the beginning, it's a grouping of SPCs that are ready to be in a cult to add that level if you're looking to do that, you know, but they're not common. If a cult was common, then it's not a cult anymore, is it? Right? I mean, by definition,
if a cult was common, I would listen to it.
If a cult's common, like, it becomes a religion, right? That's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
at what point would it start rivaling one of the sects, right?
And
at that point, we have like something all over again.
And it ceases to be interesting. So that's the thing to remember. But it does, like Nick pointed out, when you have to think of a coterie and the reasons of being in a coterie, it's not just the group you have to play with at the table. You need to think of a reason as to why you're in a coterie. And it could just be people I hang out with at night socially. Right? That's it. Honestly, it can be. We're at Humanity 7. We're at Humanity 7. We all go to the club together. That's great. That starts it. But there's going to be drama in our stories based on that. And and storytellers forget that. They forget that. That's the importance there, is that, you know, a night in the life, not the whole tale of their amazing canon Methuselah find they're trying to race to get to. And case in point, Landon Dankworth. I'm going to bring this up.
Show me what's dank. Show me what's
Landon
dank.
Landon Dankworth is a vampire redneck. I'm going to give you no room or leeway for it. All right? Why? This guy is, I won't even say he's cleverly a racist. You know, he's like dyed in the wool, but not just that, he's classist. Not just that, he feels that he grew up with great work ethic and drive and everything else, and believes he pulled himself up by his bootstraps and everybody should be able to do it and get rich doing it, just like him and his family did. And if you can't do it, well, then you suck, right? That's what it is.
Where have I heard that kind of stuff?
And not only do you suck, it's because you're brown, right? Because you come up with excuses. right? He believes that other minorities have these excuses for why what happens to him happens to him. But if they would just shut up, do their part, just like everyone else has an opportunity to, they can be a Dankworth. Now, what...
They could be a Dankworth.
I feel like this is the mentality, like, if you live in Canada and you watch American politics on TV, like, this is the impression you get of, like, one side, that, like, oh, they're clearly, like, all this kind of craziness. Like, it's almost like it's a character.
So I will caution you. The brilliance of the writing of this character is that it focuses on an individual who lives this lifestyle, who has it. I've met a person that thinks like this guy. That, like, he reminds me of someone I've met in my life that thinks like this guy.
I think we all
that,
have.
That is in there, and that's what it takes it from. And I don't take it as a caricature. I think it is a very real, not even templated. This guy's name's Landon Dankworth and isn't trying to blanket anybody. You know, this is a shoe. If this is your shoe, wear it and bury yourself somewhere. Because I don't want to meet a person who fucking thinks like this guy personally. But I think it's interesting what happens to him in the world of darkness. Now, in the right circumstances, in the wrong bar, in the good part of town, I'll say, he finds that there's an anarch vampire who's, honestly, the sole reason I zeroed in on Dankworth, because this is arguably one of the best written anarchs I've ever read. For one reason.
Court Brooks?
Okay. Oh, yeah. For one reason. Court Brooks was an anarch in theory, but had never fought against anyone or for anything. instead possessing a semi-objective idea that a vampire could make themselves important and powerful through sheer force of will and work. Now, why I point that out is because that is the importance of being an anarch. He didn't grab somebody's cause and run with it. He was trying to find his own. That's the essence of an anarch, is that you're your own immortal. You're figuring out for you. You're not figuring out for anyone else. And so, to have that canon outline, to have Court Brooks in creation, and the term anarch in theory, it's not anarch as in an anarch can look at him and go, well, he's not really an anarch. No, the theory of what it is to be an anarch is what that sings to me. And this dude heard this bigoted guy sit in the corner saying this, that, the other thing, but the important part that stuck in his head was that, or he or she stuck in his head, said that powerful through sheer force of will and work. That it's doable. That belief he felt is true. And is it not true? Enough experience, enough time, a vampire could, through enough of what they do, become strong in themselves under their own right. And well, he wanted to see it through. So he makes Dankworth and leaves. He makes Dankworth to go, the sun sucks, fire's worse, you gotta feed on blood now and deal with it. And I hope you got some wealth, but if not, I'm certain we'll see each other again later. Slaps him on the shoulder, walks away. Why I like it, it couldn't have happened to a better guy.
Yeah, because he's just like, hey, hard work, you'll get through, right? As he bumps him in the shoulder and leaves the bar bathroom that he embraced him in. Also, first off, Landon Dankworth, his entire existence is nothing but hypocrisy. He's talking the entire time about how hard work and not complaining will get you everything, and he does nothing but complain about those that are quote-unquote beneath him on the ladder, or people of colors. And this guy pissed me off. I think he singled it out to me because, like you guys, I've seen these people in real life. I grew up with them.
I don't think you understand Dankworth, or in that case, the people you grew up with. Because what they were saying is they were warning you, young buck, about the dangers of these people that are out there. That clearly there are people that won't work as hard as the person talking to you was talking about how hard they work to become rich in life. And naturally, they were telling you from their palisade in Ecuador, right? About how they've done so well for themselves. That's where they were talking to you, right? That's where they ended up from it. And they pointed out that path. And it's the same mentality of the people that said, hey, if you go to university and you graduate, 6-figure salary guaranteed. All you got to do is get that degree. Just go ahead and do it. Well, bottom line, what they're highlighting is the fact that the era or wherever you come from, this belief is not, he's a victim of it. Langdon is a victim of it. Where he grew up, the focal point had no room for him to be cosmopolitan. There was nowhere for him to have an opposing culture or friend combinations to kind of hear and challenge these thoughts and beliefs. And that's what he became. But that's not the point. The point of this is Court Brooks says, I don't care what he believes in. Hey, he's a racist. Yeah, let me embrace him. Hey, by the way, I noticed that your neighbors are all Hispanic and black. You're going to only feed on white people. Yeah, best of luck. And he walked away, right? Because he knows that's not true. I really feel Court Brooks is like, that is so not important. Once you become a vampire, you'll get it. And in a way, Langdon kind of did. Right? In a way. And it's and what's great about this character is you get to decide where Langdon goes with this. Right? He gets this whole idea that he's gonna take over the town type thing and really make something of himself, but is it gonna work? And that I enjoy it because the cheeky part for me is the dark humor of the character. That this guy injected in any chronicle is going to be someone that you're going to either have steamroll because you have that type of humor to you, or what happens if he builds a community of like-minded people? Remember, one of the coolest things about Langdon is that he learned that lupines are real. And he knows they're all around. Well, not in his community. He believes the Second Amendment, right to bear arms. He tells everybody, you need to bear arms. Everyone needs guns. Everyone be armed always. Why? Well, because you never know when you got to defend your community. You never know when it's going to happen. Secretly, Langdon knows the werewolves every night are howling, and he's seen a few. And when they show up, he needs everybody to shoot him.
Yeah, because those guys secretly have the right to wolf arms.
I think it's a great character for that because it's almost like he didn't become a vampire to become powerful. He became a vampire to survive in the world of darkness. Like, it happened to him, but he's like, my neighborhood's actually way worse than I thought it was.
Then I thought, yep, that sounds about right.
I need help.
I actually have a character to bring up. Speaking of, Roberto Vega happens to be my character of choice. His epithet is the digital apip. And for Roberto Vega, he's a Tremere. His life was very simple. It was grew up in Cali, Colombia, that is, away from drug cartels, trying to get up into doing anything he could to not end up in that particular type of lifestyle. Ends up doing the .com stuff. It works out for him. And in the process of doing so, he makes money. He makes so much money, especially doing it with casinos, where he started to recognize algorithms that work out in his favor. His sire picks him up, says, you could do this. I'll give you something more than wealth. Takes it as every other person who's hopeful of wanting to take a big bite of that vampiric chunk does. And he gets sent over to Hartford, works on this project called the Hyperion Mechanism. And of course, he's just trying to figure it all out. But what's scary about it is he does get to see behind the veil, and his ability to predict those chaotic things almost reminds me of that movie Pi. Where we were talking about the Gematra and just being able to see those that chaos theory starting to come into effect, he starts seeing where it's a bad idea being Tremere, and it's not going to be any better for him. He goes to Vienna at a certain point in time. He fixes it so he doesn't have to go to Vienna. Obviously, we know what happens there. Everyone starts looking at him distrustfully. He's like, you know what? I was already having enough trouble being under this structure. I didn't want to be under my sire. I didn't want to be under the pyramid. And lo and behold, he flees. Off to Philadelphia he goes. He comes in as a Malkavian. Someone catches his bullshit, and it happens to be a ministry member, more specifically a Church of Set member, and she goes like, I could offer you something better. And that's where his story begins. One of the things that makes it interesting is he chummies up to the prince, but that's because one of the whispers there is he pretty much thinks and or told the prince, I know when your life is going to end. And that prince is like, really? He's like, yep. Prince is like, well, you got to help me out then. Let me know how to evade my fate. What of an awesome, like, that's how you become useful to a prince. You convince him of your bullshit to be able to do that. But I think what makes it crazier about it is this is a perfect opportunity for you playing a Tremere character to figure out what you're going to do once the pyramid broke off. Because you have no one else to rely on. You got to figure out how to become useful to someone. And how does that happen? One, this character decided to become a Setite, for lack of a better term. So he's a member, card-carrying member on his own right. Two, he's playing everyone. And three, he made himself invaluable to the prince, or he's making himself valuable to someone by holding this back. And all the while, he's trying to evade the Tremere coming after him.
How hard was it to make yourself invaluable to the prince that ghouled Miss Cleo? I mean, come on. Come on. Call me now for your bumbleclod reading. Right? Ghoul her. She can predict my future. She knows who the next prince is.
I feel like that prince never read Macbeth because the weird sisters were not his friend. And weren't they the ones that told him, hey, you're going to die?
That's how Brentron's going to use that character. He's just going to have an epiphany one day. Oh, wait a minute, Macbeth. Right? We could...
Macbeth. Yeah, right? That's the linchpin to all of my plans.
Wait a sec. Wait a minute. All right. Because of time, there are two things we're going to mention, and I want to get to the other stuff because I know you guys have been waiting for the second part, not just the SBCs. First, we're going to talk about Gums because Gums is the best Nos Cleopatra ever written in the history of vampire. We're just going to call it out. Gums is great. I'm not going to ruin Gums by telling you the ins and outs, other than to say that from the selection, how the sire embraced her, the outcome of her life, the tragedy she's now living, and her obsession with the Nictaku. Finally, somebody gets it. That if you were embraced Nosferatu, it matters what you went through, and your life still matters. It's not like you have been... So many times someone tells me, I'm going to play Nosferatu. Okay, who were you in life? It doesn't matter, because now I have the underground kingdom to live in, and I've abandoned it. What? Like, no, it still matters. Like, you had family and a life and everything in it and blah, 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 but I can't go back to it. Well, yeah, that's part of the tragedy. You ever noticed that your clan symbol was like a mask with a teardrop? It's, like, sad to be what you are. It's like a bad drawback. There's a meaning there. That's why you play it. Nah, I want to be able to disappear, talk to rats, and swim in the sewers and have hidey holes and traps. All right. Seems to be where that goes. But then Children of the Blood came out, and here's Gloria Flores, Gums, who can't talk normal. Is so warped by what she went through. She used to be beautiful. And I'm going to say this much. Her savage sire walked in, sat down, ugly and hideous as he was, with his thugs and said, you got to finish my consultation. And if you can do it without getting grossed out, I'll let you keep your beauty. And she thought that he meant scar her horribly or whatever. But when you got to go over and touch somebody's makeup, and parts of his skin drop off in your hand or it's attached to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she vomited. And guess what? He said, too bad. You were one of the pretty ones. I'm going to leave it at that. It gets worse for her from that point forward. Now, the way they wrote it, she had the body to die for and a beauty to match. And she had a business of beauty to where she, like, basically Hollywood was where she was headed towards. All them fancy people, dream shattered. Look what she becomes. And I was finally captured the essence of tragedy that should exist in an Nosferatu character with a nice gem. The fact that she keeps her company through a friend, right? The same friend she started her empire with, and she acts as a client by keeping an eye on them and on this person and making sure that the money's fueled and everything's going great because she still believes in her dream of getting back to it. Cool character flaw and quirk is the fact she has mannequins all over the place that she dolls up perfectly with her skill to remind her she still has it. This is all meat and drink to me of a character I would more love to see in any game, honestly, because there's someone terrifying. And I'll leave you to look her up to figure out the connection with the Nictu, because I still agree, we talk about the stuff in this book, but let's leave you something to get it for it. And the second mention here, and it's an honorable mention, goes to Akawa. Akawa is from, I believe, all the way back first that he was even in there for Chicago by Night, talking about what went on, Native American, Bruja embraced. Talk a little bit about his sire mentioned, but it really doesn't get into detail. They beautifully outlined who he was, what his life was like, why he was embraced, his sire he did afterward, what he did in the interim, countering Milwaukee, ending up there, Prince Decker, joining the Anubai, what the Anubai were like in the beginning, which I think is the biggest insight pieces for people who are fans of Milwaukee and Prince Decker, to shed some light to it and to understand that this Kawa was kick-ass, is a great character. However, despite what I feel about that character, there's something you're going to see in here, and it's missing convictions and ambitions, and literally lists none that it has for both of them. And you're going to think it's a misprint. I thought about it too. No, I did not check and double-check. This book is fairly new. But I didn't let that hold me back. I think it's done on purpose. I think Akawa is such an old character, been in many edition for Vampire at this point, that you might have a game where he exists and has done stuff in it. Like, it's a very real risk that you've used this character. And because of that, they don't want to pigeon-toe you in what they want, what they're saying Akawa would be about. Instead, they leave it open, after telling you his history and his layout, to adjust accordingly and spice the taste. It's literally a gem character, I feel, given to show what he's about and what it could be. And there's enough written in it for his plot seeds that it those ignite an entire chronicle understanding what he's about. I mean, that's a Bruja Elder, and a damn good one. And nice touch-up, guys, is what I'm saying. For me. But rolling through, let's talk about some of these cults and their merits in here that they've added. Now, cult spirit that they built, highlighting the comparative, I put it in the Minds of the Night here, because, or the comparative Minds of the Night, because we already mentioned Sejanus. And this is Sejanus' cult. Now, I was shocked going through here and reading this because I don't know what to expect from good old Sejanus, right? The way he was written, it was like the world's going to go down. He wanted to get his hands in the nuke. That guy had some dark thoughts. The old Roman wants to reset everything. And then I like to think someone said, well, let's make this make sense. Let's attach a little reality. He did rule DC, and he was in DC for a reason. He didn't get found out by Theo Bell, blah, blah, blah. I feel that was allowed. That's part of a plan to shake things up. This guy doesn't want one city. He wants the world. Conquest is in his blood. How do you do that? You shake it up. He knew he was surviving the fallout. Ain't no group of Archons or a pack of Sabacc gonna drop this dude. He been up and walking around. He'll smoke them all if that's what he wants to do. And that's, I mean, this is Sejanus. It's capable for him to do so. So instead, put up a mirror and look at Mithras and see what Mithras has accomplished through the ages, right? What he's able to do by being hidden, manipulating, and doing it himself, letting mortals run with the cult idea, or what I think, he took the cult idea and let himself become that. And that's smart. That's brilliant. It's lasted centuries. Still working, even. Sejanus has a form of it. He went and embedded himself to figure out and learn how mortal institutions work, turned around and said, the comparative minds in the night, he has a goal with them. One of them is the control of the First Inquisition. Right? And roll that up to the Second Inquisition, right? Understand their origins to understand the modern, and now you have a key piece of the puzzle. They were able to accomplish a lot doing it. But what he wants is a lasting piece. Right? Or the final piece, or they creepily call it in cult fashion. And whatever that, we want that to mean in your chronicle, but we know what that is. It's going to be a world where he finally rules all. That's what it is, in whatever form that takes. They write in here, though, this cult and how they meet up and connect. They get together to discuss that basically there's a concept of disciplines in that there's not differences in who you are as vampires. Vampires are vampires. And they bring them in under a thought process of one rule. And when I read this, I went, here's the brilliance. By telling you all you're of Rome, we push the agenda of Rome. See how that works? If I dissolve your ability to say that you're of a clan or a different type of blood because your discipline sets you apart and your weaknesses are different, no, we're all vampires. That's what it counts. We're all immortals. We have forever to dictate a way of being. But these three people have a very unique aspect of how this is interpreted. And that's what I like about it. Like, there's conflicts built in that Gloria is using with everyone to kind of showcase and tie that together. But I'm only going that deep because in here it does tell you basic coterie charts to show you how the people get along, what it takes to make and set up a coterie as a sample, kind of putting forth what they intended from Cult of the Blood Gods. Here's what it should look like for you. If you needed the training wheels to help you out, here's that provided. And here's some insights into what to do. That's all gravy. That all we know. But to spare you that specifically, did you guys have a cult that you felt that outlined that had a unique, oh man, this is a must get, or a lean or a mean or anything? Background, merit, flaw? Rest of this book, I guess?
Oh, rest of this book? Hell yeah, I did. This is one that is that I never knew much about the Milliner really before this. I'll go ahead and say that now. But reading through their lore sheet, they're probably one of my favorite out of the whole Hakata bunch. And that is largely due to their epitaph, the Grudge Masters. They, this whole, for those that may not know much about the Milliners, they are, they were a family that were beneath the Giovanni, right? But they were distinctly American, known for being...
All right, Black Dragon, you're slamming forward again. What's a milliner more important than that?
What's a milliner more than important than that?
What are they before that?
Before their politicians and money men.
I've never heard of clan. Oh, there you go. Their clans what?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Again, yeah. Assumptions are made. So they were a minor family under the Giovanni at first, right? And always considered a smaller sibling, right? They were never given their chance to shine. But with this reformation, I forget what they actually called it, but with the Hakata becoming their own clan now, well, they've got more, I guess, wiggle room to impress, and they are flexing that their political and financial muscle in America. But they're also using this opportunity to live up to their namesake, that is satisfying some of those grudges. And they have one particular lore sheet that I just couldn't get past, and it's called the Perfect Grudge. When you lose a role against an SPC, you can set up a payback plan, like immediately start planning your revenge against them, and it just sets you up for success out the gate. And I thought that was something that was so amazingly
how's it set petty. You up for success.
So there's a there's a system for setting up like long-term projects, right? A series of extended roles, I guess, if you want to drill down to it mechanically, but you track it over time, right? This could be something that could be like setting up a business, founding a cult. In this case, it's starting a plan to get revenge on someone. The initial aspect of these projects is there's a launch role, right? A role made at the beginning to start this, well, I guess what I consider like a snowball, right? Because it's got to gain momentum. You got to build successes on top of it. But you succeed on the launch roll automatically. And then for any moving towards those goals, there's a 2-die bonus on top of that.
Which works, right? It's a 2-die bonus on top. I was just letting you finish that out to walk it through. So basically what you're saying is that on here, it helps the person think of how they could get revenge in a mechanical sense, i.e.
right.
It makes more of a game out of natural thought. Here's the one part I challenge this, is that I don't know at what point we needed to totally map out the fact that if someone screws you over, you might want to get revenge on them, and here's a die roll to roll 2 dice to say that you can do that or can't do that. I don't think that die roll is going to matter much. Right? If I have a truly perfect grudge and a reason to do it, do I need this to highlight that I can or that I should? Or do I just work to do it? And what does that look like? That's the thing I would say, pointing out forward to that. That's not just me being an old hat. It's me going, we're in a dangerous territory when everything is mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because what's next?
And that's...
I got to put out my favorite food. I have to map that out. Do I regain willpower when I feed on my favorite? Does everything have to have a benefit? Do I have to show everything? And at what point do I just box together what my character's doing and we just each week tune in to roll the necessary dice to tell the next step of the tale for the character and we no longer are role-playing? Right? That's the danger here. I don't think that's what this is for. I think...
I agree.
Go for it.
Go ahead. No. I agree. I don't think that's what it is because when I... Maybe again, I'm making assumptions, right? I wouldn't think to go about it that way. I would just... What I was thinking was this in the process of going through that revenge, whenever mechanics come into play, because if you're getting revenge, there's inherently a conflict. This would be that mechanical edge, I guess, representing that that the generations of grudges being bared and revenge is being planned, just distilled down into one angry, petty milliner.
What I see this as is that this lore sheet right here is highlighting. There's a frustration I've had with people when we run games and I hear lore sheets thrown out as if this is something that sits in their sheet specifically meant for them to use when it comes into play only. And it's not. This is a classic example of that there is no what the ST sees and what the player sees. It's all on the same table. We all see what we're doing. This gives bonus dice to the ST determining outcomes of what you're doing in your downtimes for this. We know you have the perfect grudge. You tell the ST you're slighted. You make up your plan to get back at them. Whatever your plans are, the ST is taking this into account, and it's manipulating those die rolls, if there ever is a die roll, that comes into play for that mapping for you, for those results. See what I'm saying? I want to make sure we get that imagery right, because to say that it's the other way, we're now in this weird dystopian, predetermined die roll outcome in hell, but that's not what it's for. This is meant for the ST to keep track of the success of the player, how easy it is for them to accomplish stuff, because of the determination of what you submit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does from that.
If you're an ST and you thought magically you're going to sit back and have 5 players, and when 5 players are submitting blue booking and it's them taking over the city and they're submitting to you that they got these gangs and these contacts and allies and resources, they're playing it forward, and you just go, well, they got enough dots. Well, all right, you guys get it. And this is what happens. That's one way to do it. Kind of boring. Where's conflict? You know, where's the story and the drama of doing it? And the scenes that can come from there. There's a lot left on the table you could be doing. It's a planning session to go through bit by bit, but that's a lot you can forget if you don't take notes. This assumes you're taking notes as they instruct in every one of their storytelling guides they've ever written. You know, you take notes to keep up the follow along, so it's all good and gravy. That's how you need to look at the lore sheets, because that's where they sing. Right? You're saying, this I want attached to my character and why I took it, because it's important. And so that's it. That's all I have there. It's good to note, because otherwise you're going to do what I did and get here and go, this is what the player reads? What the hell does this mean? Right? Oh, great. I get two dice for what again? Because I'm pissed. When do I get those two dice? Go to 415 of Vampire the Masquerade to learn that you can hurt people because you're mad at them because they made you look foolish. Why don't I just hit them? Like, what's all this yay about? You know, it didn't make sense. But that's me.
Well, you can't hit them, Bob, and you get two dice to do it.
No, I get two dice to plan on doing it. I get two dice to sit back and bitch about doing it, which, you know, yeah, you know.
Why can't I hit him? Well, we found the Bruja.
It's right. Interesting. It's Mad Max this. Yeah. All right. Not all of them are that way. Some are obviously directly. But spice the taste, right, as it says. Pay attention. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I was impressed by the road. I mean, the one way, I think it's called.
The one true way.
Yeah. The one true way. It was really nice to see some old ideas come back in a new way. So this feels to me like a rewrite of Path of the Beast or the Road of the Beast, bringing things up, you know, ideas like riding the wave, communing with your beast. Even at the highest levels, you're able to kind of return as an apex predator, and you don't lose yourself too much when you get into your frenzy and you embrace the bestial side of you. There's obvious benefits to that. You know, as much as there is any other kind of thing that you would lose along the way. But to me, it was just nice to see it. It caught my attention. I had a small smile on the side of my face and said, oh, there we are.
I love head nods.
But it's not only that, because, you know, one of the things about it is the main biggest line here is, a traveler on the one true way, you know, like Golconda isn't about redemption, but about progression and mastery. And in V5, they mentioned to you as well, Golconda wasn't what we thought it was going to, or rather, you know, this is a story as it unfolds, right? But the story they're telling you is Golconda is not humanely peace. It's not only being on humanity. Golconda is that Ozzy the Hawk. It's finding that epiphany, right? And for them, they have it. And what's more insidious about it is their cult is built on the fact that it seems like a pyramid scheme. It's like, oh, you can't believe it. All right, you're coming to our meetings. Go ahead and confess what you're going to be doing in the first place. That's only part one. And when you confess the worst of the worst, you don't know why this quote-unquote master of the ravens or someone who's above is taking those secrets, and what they choose is useful or not useful. And on top of that, once you start getting to those higher levels, now you could start getting into what's really behind the veil, how to make use of it, how to be that beast, how to go ahead and do stuff. I thought that was really cool about it, too. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, no, I was just going to point out that the Master of Ravens, I hope that we get to finally get a better Varys the Spider than we did in Game of Thrones, is all I had to point out.
I don't think you can be better than him. I'll be honest with you. That guy was top-notch.
Yeah, he lived, but his rulers died. Different podcast. Just saying. Just saying, you know, maybe it's the same way here. Obviously no relation, but I couldn't ignore it.
I chose the Cleopatras, and I think what was cool about it was, one, when it was brought out and revised, and you remember seeing that character as a template, you're like, it had the idea of like, well, if I'm in my own personal hell, you're coming with me, and if someone has to live with my curse, you're going to live with it as well. In here, it kind of flips it, because in this, you have Nosferatu who are dreaming about this figure that's coming to them and showing them this kind of inner beauty, or kind of just giving them the ability to just push through. And this could all be BS. This could literally be specifically in their head, but the fact that certain groups believe this and the way it espouses itself is pushing through. And it's like, I could wear, in fact, let's use one of them, the five dot portion of the beauty within. You're destined to rule the kindred, not even in Cain's curse hinders you. Once per story, you're dressed in the finest clothes. You may negate your clan's bane entirely for a duration of the chapter for purposes of interaction with other vampires. Your appearance has not changed, but your intense confidence radiates and negates your blemishes. The lore has no effect on the kind, because they're going to see you. They're going to run no matter what. But amongst your peers, to know that it's almost, like I said, it's a mental trick. It doesn't even have to be supernatural, but it's enough of a mental trick that you could walk and just carry yourself. And like walking with that BDE energy and it radiates around. So
I got to challenge it though, because like I read that too and I was like, All right, so now it's a power to have confidence. That's what I had. It's a level 5. It's worth having. My character is this way, so you can't. Could I not just write that in?
You could.
Right? Can I put I'm confident as an Nosferatu? I still walk with my BDE energy, because that's just how I roll. right? That's just how it is. My style is impeccable. My rhymes are lyrical. Like, you know, whatever I wanted to throw down, I could do that. And the answer is...
He's a funky walking, dirty talking.
And the answer, I suppose, is yes. I think this is designed to do just what you're talking about. It's something to be a weird quirk to throw in that you can ignore it, and that's there. But I will forever pick on it. Because to me, for you to walk around Beauty Within and blah, blah, blah as a Cleopatra, isn't that defy the point of what you were? I mean, there's a reason you were the way you were. But then again, it's level 5. Maybe that's like your victory. You've worked long and hard. Finally, you get to do it. And you too can be in Elysium without someone vomiting in a bucket. So that's good. It's cool.
Yeah, I guess for Cleopatra's, yes. Like, it almost seems like in order to even qualify for a Cleopatra, there has to be so much self-loathing for your appearance.
There is, and I think that defines that horrific idea behind it. It's one of the great things about Nosferatu is knowing this. And I'm going to point this out. This book also highlights that it's bloodline-based. A lot of these things are like stuff they left on the table, but look how easy they made a lore sheet for it. Mm-hmm. Right? It was like, well, we may have left it behind. You want it in a book. Well, here it is in a book. You could do the same thing. Right? To think about it. I mean, a lot of these bonuses highlight just the levels and what you could do in your home game to attach to it. And they encourage usage just like that. And so I would tell you, if you see something that isn't in there, take your time with your ST, build it.
Actually, that's probably the greatest statement I've ever. Like, the question I hear the most about V5 is, how do I take my favorite thing from such and such version and bring it into V5? Lore sheet.
Right.
Easily done.
It's so easy. It's stupid easy. It just takes a little time. That's it. But if you look at the limitation they put on themselves, one sheet. Your lore sheet is one sheet. 1 through 5 done. Give yourself the same. If it doesn't fit on one sheet, then it is not good. You're already not doing well.
Right.
Right? That's how it goes. One thing I'm going to point out, and it's not that it's bad. I read this and I remember talking to Nick and I was like, how the hell does this work? Right? Under Cult of Shalim.
Empty.
Right. Under Cult of Shalim, they give them this empty, right? And what it is, this empty is basically, in short, you don't care about anything. It's like the ultimate in nihilism, right? Like, you legit have carved away everything inside of you that meant anything. Temporal joys, accomplishments, wanting to do anything, to be anything with anything. It's just gone. This emptiness radiates from you in a way that is just going to stun the uninitiated. Like, you know, you're -2 to all social, period. That's where it is. Yep. Because you walk around, like, first off, why are you walking? Right? If you should...
Yeah, and it's like you would be Eeyore, except for Eeyore still has friends. So he's not even depressing enough for this.
Right, but Eeyore's not in a cult based on ending everything. Right, bringing it all to the Shalim.
Right.
And so that's the part of it that made it scary. Was like, if someone's going to choose this, and here's this flaw... I almost feel they're saying, fine, have it, enjoy. And they walked away from it, which makes it funny to be an author for this book. I really feel they told fans, I'm tired of hearing about it. You asked if they're, well, yeah, of course it exists. Have fun. But why would you do this? You know, I've heard it said before, you know, this is like for villains. This is like for...
Yeah.
It is.
For an ST perspective, it's like every time you got a player who has this flaw, and every time they come to you with these downtimes of these awesome things you want to do, you just got to look and be like, I thought we didn't care. What is what's all these ambitions?
The Cult of Shalim is someone where they have a merit about whispers, right? Where you're able to just say the thing. They, like, everyone will have a moment of doubt in whatever their core beliefs are, and you're an expert of when you hear it, you're telling them to get rid of everything. You just cut to the quick and just help them divorce themselves away from their convictions. And it's like, okay, great. This exists, I would shoot this person if I could. What an evil bastard to sit around. Like,
it's so
cool. Yeah.
What's your purpose? Is it do you get anything for doing that? No, I don't. But do you see now? Do you see? It's like, oh, this, you can spot a Cult of Shalim a mile away. And when you do, why aren't they killed on sight? Nowhere does it say that, but they totally should be. And that's how you know they're well done.
Yeah. We talked earlier about a little bit about some of these cults having conflicts with each other, right? Cult of Cain and Baharis obviously have one, and then I think the intro story had one between between the Nephilim and DJ, who was Roberto's? And the Setites, yeah. I feel as though in the middle of that four-way brawl between all of them, if there was one Shalamite that popped up and tried to, like, start making people doubt themselves, all four would turn on that guy and just beat the crap out of him. That's how I read the Shalamites.
They're poison to a religious entity, like, in a heartbeat, right?
But I mean, like, you know, to see this in practice, especially with Insidious Whispers, is like, we go out drinking and, you know, Brentron's over and he's pretty sauced up and I'm just kind of standing next to him, just kind of sipping my stuff. And he's like, you know, I got to stop doing this. I can't keep drinking. I got to pay the rent. I've spent all my money here. My mom, you know, I got to take care of my mom, got to take care of my little brother and everything like that. And you're the person who's going like, you know what? What if you're the actual problem for your mom and your brother? Wouldn't it be better if you just walked away? Don't you understand that you're hurting them instead, and you're not going to hurt them anymore if you just aren't there? Brentron's like, you know what? You're right. I am the problem. Or they are the problem. Shit. And then that's just all you just got to do is just be there to do that. And it just takes that one little bit.
But in interest for time, we're going to wrap this up, folks. I know we talked a lot about this book and what goes in. Naturally, it's a fantastic book. Obviously, we feel that. It's great for what they intended. And, you know, fans demanded, and you got it. And I want to say this uncharacteristically. I want to thank John Berg, David Cartwright, Dixie Cochran, Matthew Dawkins, Jose Garcia, Chris Handley, Clara Hoshkar-Herbol, the Lady Gamer, Lauren Roy, and Eddie Webb. They're the authors in this book that did a great job, Dawkins and the Lady Gamer, or Clara, because I can never pronounce her name right. I don't think anyone can but her. You did a fantastic job with this book. Even the artwork was good, in my opinion, hands down, and being provocative and keeping you engaged and didn't distract from the great writing within. Typically, we don't list every author like that because we're like, it's in the credits in the book and doing it. I'm going to make sure that they, because some of you listen, if you hear this, you know that yes, this is quality. This is something we think that more people need to get their hands on and enjoy. I feel this was written when you guys were fans of the game. Well, you're still fans of the game, but before you became authors in a book, you were with everybody else in the cheap seats, enjoying the writings that came out, and you listened and you did it. And so it's a labor of love, and we appreciate it here at 25. Once again, folks, thanks for listening. We will resume next week, and we are doing Requiem. That's right, Requiem gets a slide in because Werewolf had a book that we had to pass over. That doesn't mean that we do a Werewolf book next. It means to go back to Requiem and then Werewolf and so on and so forth. Thank you, of course, DJ, Brentron, and Nick. I know I was a bastard in saying let's get this out as quick as possible just so we could tell folks about it, because we really want people to rush and get it. Definitely all our fans, because you're huge fans of V5. Don't miss this. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to our 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast. If you liked what you heard, please reach out and let us know on Twitter at 25 Years of VTM, at our email, info@25yearsvtm.com, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/25yearsvtm, or on our website, www.25yearsvtm.com. If you would like to support us, we can be found at patreon.com/25yearsofvampirethemasquerade.